Hello, everybody. Welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're a trio in this studio. I've got two guests from the El Paso Zoo. One is the director of the zoo, and his name is Steve Marshall. And the other is the veterinarian, or one of the veterinarians. I think there's more than one.
Two.
I'm not totally sure. And her name is Dr. Vicky Milne, Victoria Milne. So, Steve, Vicky, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks.
Nice to be here, Keith.
And you're new returnee.
I'm a science studio alum.
Talked about elephants and nails and all sorts of interesting things. I remember it well. So let's start, though, with Steve. You're the director. Before we get into what you do as a director and the importance and the relevance of zoos, tell us a little bit about Steve. When you were a kid, what made you think you were going to do something in science or animal behavior? How did this develop?
Well, I appreciate this opportunity. I was always outside as a kid. My parents made sure that's all the fun stuff was going to be. I grew up hunting, fishing, canoeing, backpacking, just running through creeks with my friends before it got dark, before we had to be home.
So you're not a native West Texan.
Exactly. Did the creeks give it away? Great. Or maybe my accent. No, I grew up in East Tennessee, actually. And so, when Wild Kingdom came on, or Jacques Cousteau, or one of those were primetime specials back then. And it was an event at our house. And I just really did appreciate the interpretation of nature as a foreign language to the masses. I appreciated that effort. And so as I went on and got a master's degree in animal behavior and was teaching actively, I thought that was where I was going to end up. But I ended up back at a nature center where I had done an internship and got involved in helping with school groups that came out to the Nature Center.
Was this all in East Tennessee?
It was. It was. I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Chattanooga. So I've got a son that's at Oak Ridge. That's also East Tennessee.
That's close, yes. It's East Tennessee.
It's that far end.
It's north,
very long
east
and spread out.
It is.
Tennessee.
It is.
You know, I remember we drove through it once from Georgia, and I thought, oh, we'll just go through Tennessee. Whoosh, just like going through Texas. It just keeps going on. And Vicky, just let's remind the listeners, for those of them that don't quite remember your last program, your background?
Well, I'm a veterinarian. I grew up in Florida. I did my undergrad in New York, and I went to vet school in Davis. So that's a four-year program, just like med school, but harder to get into.
Yes, and Davis is a good school.
Yeah, I loved California. But I've always wanted to not be stuck in an office. So I didn't want to be, looking at dogs and cats inside all day.
You're a large animal veterinarian.
I am an exotic animal veterinarian. So I do large and small. When I was just starting as like a technician and my first jobs in veterinary clinics in between semesters at school were in small animal clinics. So I started out more familiar with the small animal. I was also the kid. My mom was a nurse. My family is full of nurses. And so I kind of came from that bit of medical background.
Okay.
And had always been exposed to it. And so I was the kid who was always wrapping up the dog's leg with the leftover, bandaging material that mom would bring home. So it was just fate. I think I was going to be medical.
Regardless,
and I was
right.
Just loved animals too much to do it with people.
Exotic animal veterinarian. That sounds pretty damn good.
Okay, it's
Steve. So let's get to the chase here. What's the role of a zoo in modern society? What's it sort of, not just for children and adults to go and look, but it's got to be more substantial than that. So why don't you tell us what your vision is of any zoo, and then we'll get specific about our zoo.
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a great opportunity for Dr. Vicky now to be here to talk about this, because we in this profession, we are also questioning this, and it allows us to get better and better. That is a modern zoo relative to our society now? And the answer is absolutely more so now than ever. There's an extinction crisis out there. There's planetary issues with resources. Resources we need. Imagine the Earth as a spaceship. That spaceship, as it goes through Earth, it needs water, it needs air, it needs materials to do what is necessary to do to sustain life within the spaceship. So all those things are at risk. And
So what's at risk for us, which we think we've got some capacity to control, is at risk for animals who don't have anybody out there other than us to sort of facilitate their survival.
Absolutely. It's the proverbial canary in the coal mine situation. And again, it's also the first order of tinkering is to keep all the parts. We certainly haven't been keeping all the parts lately. There's been plenty of examples of animals that have been absolutely declared extinct in the wild, that zoos have collaborated with other non-governmental agencies, governmental agencies, First People tribes that have then bred these animals in managed care and then reintroduced them back into the wild.
I've heard of condors in particular.
Absolutely.
That's one of the big stories.
Condors was one of those. Right. They were down to 28 individual animals.
In the whole of the Americas?
In the whole world, that particular condor species. Black-footed ferrets, exactly the same thing, down to 24 animals. Asian wild horses, completely extinct in the wild. Mexican wolves from here. Mexican wolves were completely extirpated from their home range, and the El Paso Zoo is taking a part in that. But, and we can talk about this more if you want to, but that is not the main reason that zoos are relative. The reason is our messaging and the experience that people can receive from coming and seeing things as an example of nature.
Okay, that's a lot of things there, but let me go to what I'm particularly interested in from what you just stated, and that is that trying to go from a few species or a few examples in a species, growing them within controlled environments and then releasing them, apart from the ones that we just talked about, the condor, which I think has been relatively successful, what are the other good success stories? And what are the stories where it just doesn't work? You know, you breed something in captivity. I'll call it captivity. Maybe you don't like that word for a zookeeper and zoo director, but it's some form of captivity.
Right.
And then you put the poor fellows out there or the girls out there, and they can't cope.
Well, I can address some of
yeah,
that.
Please. Dr. Vicky, I love this. Dr. Vicky.
we're formal, informal, right? We're very cognizant of that animals in a controlled environment don't get all the same experiences that animals in growing up in a wild environment can get and learn from and become successful in that wild environment. A lot of those animals don't make it. And when we are trying to build up a species, then we will try to give them a head start. So by controlling some of the environment in human care, we are able to have often higher success rates for the offspring, you know, because they haven't been selected against as much, which, again, it may or may not be a problem for them in the long run. So it's not a perfect system. But knowing what we've learned from decades as zoos of doing this, we're always trying to improve how we're preparing those animals for the wild. So it definitely isn't a matter of, you know, if I have a thick-billed parrot, for example, on exhibit at the El Paso Zoo and he's lived there for 20 years, that's not the individual I'm going to pull out and put in the wild. But he could be the parent of an individual that is actually pulled away from the public and brought up in a facility that is either larger, more naturalistic, or exactly in the climate, something that we can support and supply with individuals that can be raised in a way that enables them to survive in the wild.
That's interesting, because I remember when pandas are put into zoos and they try to make those recreate or reproduce, should I say.
Right.
Tough, very tough. They don't seem to have the same sexual drive as some other species. I mean,
and there are things
that
what
determines
discover?
Things like that?
Those are individual species variations, and it is something that we have to study and try to figure out. It's a puzzle with every animal. They can be different. So we've learned that some animals require two males to have some kind of a competition before they'll all feel ready. Okay, we've selected the right guy. Yeah, well, even just to get the hormonal responses in, it's their behavior is tied to their biology, and we know that. So we have to be able to help both of those, the biology, but also permit the behavior that gets that biology going. So, you know, there are definitely situations where we've learned, and sometimes it's through trial and error, and sometimes that can be a sad story because maybe it didn't go well at first. But the people working on these things are very dedicated, really want nature to succeed, and work really hard to try to get the combination right and get the care right for those animals.
I have just a bit of your example of pandas. I was in charge of the panda program at Zoo Atlanta. And how is it possibly selective for a female to ovulate one day out of a year? I don't understand
I didn't know that was the case.
That's the case.
And is it clear when?
Clear to the pandas. It's not clear to us.
When we went in trying to do this.
And again, but in the mountains of China, when there's multiple males competing for one female that's around and there's all these great pheromones and hormone activities and behaviors, it works there. But, of course, the habitat has been so deeply disturbed there. And, again, there's so few animals left. That selectivity isn't working anymore in the wild.
I didn't really think about ovulation and the periodicity of it. Once a year seems to be rather inadequate. But how does that – are there animals that have a longer period?
Oh, yes. Dr. Vicky, there's –
Well, there are animals, for example, elephants that become pregnant and are pregnant for 2 years. So, you know, they can't possibly ovulate again for over 2 years. So there's individual biology all over the place.
But once they've had the offspring,
they'll cycle more frequently until
I guess it was the cycle that I'm thinking about. Right. I mean, rabbits seem to ovulate every day, I guess. I don't know why I say that.
You would think.
It's an expression that people use. Right. But what's longer than a panda? I'm interested in this.
Everything is longer than a panda. There's your answer. Almost everything ovulates more than once every 365 days.
That's the longest monthly cycle.
Yeah, that's the longest inactivity period. And you've got to, the male pandas need to be there right at that moment, and everything needs to be ready. And that is difficult to reproduce in managed care in zoos.
Artificial insemination by donor, does that work for animals?
For some species, yes, and for some species, no. The biggest challenge that we have with artificial insemination, because there are people trying it in a lot of species that have this challenge of you've got suitable males on one side of the country in one facility, and you've got a female that's a great genetic match for diversity on the other side of the country, and maybe it's not the best thing to move both of those animals or one of those animals. So you'd rather just move the sperm, and that would make life a lot more easy. But unfortunately, the semen storage is the biggest challenge in a lot of those stories. So we've got that down for our domestic animals and for people, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we do not have that down for some of the other species. There, the individual requirements to be able to freeze semen and then thaw it and have viable
activity,
sperm
right.
is different species to species. So what you put it in, how long you freeze it, what temperature you freeze it, how quickly you freeze it. There are a couple of institutions that have laboratories in their zoos working on exactly that. So there are people just doing that for endangered species, and they are working hard, and it is challenging.
So many interesting questions. But you mentioned something that I didn't really think about, because we don't do it deliberately with human species, but you try to match them genetically so that there's an increase in diversity.
Absolutely.
And I think that's very interesting. And I want to go back to this business of deliberately trying to augment diversity.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about this as being a role of people in zoos or anywhere else for that matter.
Let me generally answer,
yes.
And then I'll throw it to our chief veterinarian over here. And that is,
you guys are great, by the way. You make a good team.
Right? We do make a good team, actually. Collectively, accredited zoos across North America and further, collectively, we manage these animal populations together. The El Paso Zoo has 7 zebras. That's not a breeding population of viable offspring. So we collectively manage.
Oh, so the issue there is they would become incestuous.
Yes.
And that would decrease.
Right.
So this is what we're really talking
about.
That's
what we're really talking about.
Because
yes.
Every zoo doesn't have a large enough population
no.
of every given species.
Oh, absolutely not.
So that's why we need to work on getting this really viable group of accredited zoos that are respected and do the best that they possibly can for animal welfare, animal well-being, for conservation education messaging, for experience delivery, for guests. We want that group of zoos and aquariums and nature centers and bioparks to be working together on this problem of how are we going to preserve all the pieces in the puzzle. Dr. Vicky?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I would say. And I think that's one of the things that people don't realize about zoos, and especially AZA-accredited zoos, is we are working as a big team. So it's not just the El Paso Zoo out here deciding that we're going to have some zebra and some lions and do what we will with them. We are managing these animals together with all of the other zoos that are part of AZA to maintain genetic diversity, to set high goals for welfare and animal care. So we aren't working alone. The Malayan sun bear at the El Paso Zoo is considered part of the SSP population for the entire North America.
Let's just talk about the Malayan sun bear. Is that what you call it?
Sure. That's just tell us, one of our
what
critters.
Does it look like, and why is it a sun bear?
The Malayan sun bear is the smallest bear species.
Smaller than Winnie the Pooh?
Side by side, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Winnie the Pooh's species of origin.
Yeah, isn't he a grizzly bear?
Sussex, England. Hartfield, Sussex, England. I know it well.
But yeah, so the Malayan sun bear is a really cool bear. They are from Southeast Asia. They are the smallest bear. They're very good at climbing. They love fruit, bugs. So they're one of the more frugivorous of bears. We think of bears as omnivores. Malayan sun bears are very fruit-oriented and plant-oriented as well as insects and digging out termites. They love that kind of thing. But that's just an example of species that is facing challenges in the wild. And then zoos have tried to help by creating an assurance population. So
you have this association of zoos. Let's just take North America
sure.
for the moment, and I'll include Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The climates vary. Are there certain rules and regulations that says, look, El Paso, Texas gets pretty damned hot in the summer, so we think it's not a good idea for you to have this, and that animal. And then you go up to Winnipeg or somewhere, and they say the same thing. You know, it's just too cold, and so you cannot have this species. Are there rules and regulations, or is there just a word of mouth that it's not sensible to put certain animals in certain locations?
You know, a lot of it is common sense, and zoos are required to have a criteria by which they choose the animals that they work with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all that's left by this regulatory group. It's voluntary. But there's just a requirement to have a criteria, to have a thought process, rather than someone just saying, you know, let's get Arctic penguins and put them in an open exhibit in the middle of the zoo in El Paso. We're about to get penguins, but we're getting South American penguins. We're getting more warm weather penguins from the southern coast of South America. Most everybody has been saying, oh, you're going to build something for
cold
Arctic penguins, and there are lots of species. There's penguins in Africa. There's penguins in Australia.
I've seen the ones in Australia,
right, yeah,
but from an incredible distance.
Right.
I mean, they look so
well. They're very teeny. They're very small.
The
right.
Ones, yeah.
The blue penguins or fairy penguins. Mm-hmm. I believe those are the ones.
Okay.
Right. So again, it's left up to us to make sure that we have the keeper staff that understands these animals, and even the medical requirements of certain specific animals.
And that's all part of the accreditation process. So as being part of AZA, a group of our peers will come and check out what we've done over the last 5 years. It's very intense. And one of the things they're looking at is, have you provided adequately for the animals that you've decided to have here at the zoo? Do you have the expertise on staff to take care of them well? For something like the sun bear, going back to that example, or the penguin, it's not necessarily someone dictating that we can't have that species here. It's more the question of, how are you going to make it okay for that species here if you decide to take that on? So, and if we can't, then we're not going to be accredited and we're not going to get those animals.
I mean, if you bring in a species that's sort of not really adapted, two things. One, do they get morose and unhappy? And two, do they ever adapt? I mean, like the penguins you were talking about, they're all part of the penguin species. So one of their relatives loves it much more cold. Can they adapt?
Well, again, let's take the penguins. We're going to make sure that the water temperature is adequate for them to meet their needs. Our sea lions from the California coast, we keep them in, 52-degree water?
Yeah, 50 to 60.
Yeah, that's Pacific Coast current water.
Right.
So we meet them more than halfway. We provide to them everything that they need.
But the question, if I can go back to it, do different species learn to adapt or not? I mean, when we're thinking of, let's say, global warming, there I've said it again, global warming, all right? Animals are going to migrate, right, to keep in the temperature range they want. Or are they going to adapt? Clearly, people, we adapt, right? But Can animals so readily adapt to the change of temperature, for example?
I think we have to say yes and no. It's going to be different species by species. And that is some of that information is exactly what people are studying in relation to climate change. So there are some animals who are going to be better at adapting than other animals, and some animals who really are going to need to move to find that same similar environment, and they might not be able to. And that's part of that whole challenge of climate change and why it's so important that we try to minimize it. That's a whole issue. But back to the question of, can they adapt to our climate, for example, coming from a different climate? And I think there are a lot of things that we do to mitigate how bad that difference is. So if we feel that it's important that a certain species is here because we have maybe the personnel or a really good reason or facility to work with that species, but maybe they require a much higher humidity, for example. And that's one of our biggest challenges. We have a lot of animals that like the temperatures we have, but not necessarily our dryness. So we have to deal with those issues. So we provide humidification. We provide indoor environments. We provide the opportunity for that animal to get into and out of higher humidity environments to kind of regulate its own situation.
So that's interesting.
So we try to modify.
Yeah, because then the zoo must have a pretty big need for water. All right. I'm just wondering, is there some nice relationship between the zoo and the El Paso Water Company to give you a special break?
We don't get a special break. We're a very good client. We work with them.
Oh, that's a pity.
But again, we're a good client. We're also a good partner with them. They have water conservation messages, and we actually share those same type of messages. We actually house the El Paso Water Discovery Center on zoo grounds. They were able to donate several years ago to a classroom and an exhibit area that's almost like a sister facility to Tech H2O. Not near as big.
What I should know, I haven't been to the zoo in 15 years.
You're breaking my heart.
Well, my wife was there about a month ago, and this is why you're here today.
Good.
But the water discovery issue. What? Tell us what that is.
Well, when we were building the African section under the 2000 bond, there's a limit to those funds. And of course, we were going to have to adjust some of the plans. And so the El Paso Zoological Society, our 501c3 not-for-profit support organization, approached the water utility and said, we'll put your name on this building if you give us the funds because it's about to hit the editing floor. And so they did, and we have education offices, and we have also a public space that talks about water conservation. And they thought it was a good idea because of the over 350,000 people a year that we see. And it was a great window into their operation.
That's interesting. There was an article, I was at an airport and picked up a newspaper. I think it was the Wall Street Journal, and it was all about a big, big article, actually, about the killing off of different species. And then I heard the other day on Saturday, which made me do something today. On Saturday, I heard that the whale had beached somewhere in Indonesia and was dead. And so then people like Dr. Vicky here went and cut it up to do some scientific research. What does it eat? And they found 15 pounds of plastic. And I went into we have a coffee room next to my office just for my own group, and I just said, plastic cups out, get your own China cup.
Right.
I mean, I just
Absolutely.
The thought of one whale, and I know they're big, but 15, and plastic is light, so the volume before it got compacted.
I'm almost inviting myself back with Dr. Vicky. This could be a complete whole segment that you do on single-use plastic ocean trash. We have a huge effort at the zoo. We're completely eliminated single-use plastic bottles for beverages at the zoo. We've cut way back on straw use. We don't give away those plastic bags anymore in our gift shop.
Straws have always confused me. I mean, wherever you go, they give you water and they give you a straw. And I had a straw when I was three. I guess I gulp. Thank God they don't give you a straw with beer, right?
Well, I'm starting to carry around metal straws, because sometimes you just do want a straw. And there's a lot of things we can do. And so you've invited Dr. Vicky and I to talk about exactly the kind of things that the zoo is involved in. This is what the Modern Zoo does. The Modern Zoo tells its consumers, the people that come to purchase an experience from us, we then get to tell them when they're in that emotional state of awareness that you can change your consumer behavior and you can help. The ecosystem and individual animals within it are extremely resilient until pushed to that point.
Mm-hmm. There's a tipping point for everything.
There is a tipping
there
point.
Is. And
we don't know where that is right now.
Yeah, we are currently in an extinction crisis. We are already tipping. And so I think that everybody at the zoo is desperate for that message to get out to the people that come. We're hoping that we can be a gateway drug for conservation. People come in. You learn about these animals and they're amazing. And we're hoping that that spurs people to take action.
From your perspective, as people dealing with animals, habitat, genetic mixing, the wall would be deleterious?
Yes, it would. There's a lot of animals that move across that space. And some type of solid barrier to keep animals from doing what they do to support the ecosystem that then we rely on is not productive.
Is that possible to amplify that at some stage? Because I, you know, it sounds right, but then you ask people, well, give us what are you talking about?
Right.
And then they'll talk about the jaguar or something like that, when no one's seen a bloody jaguar in Texas for 50 years. All right.
Well, but I mean, there are common species. For example, the black bear is making a comeback in Big Bend. National Park.
Steve, you know, you just said I should invite you back, you know, to talk, because there are more issues here than one can get through in 28 minutes. So I think we're going to have to sort of call a halt right here. But I will be going back to the zoo now. And I say my wife, Laura, went there and said, Keith, you got to go. It's wonderful. And so I'd like to congratulate you both.
Thank you.
On bringing it up to whatever level it is, and presume that you're constantly working to get to that next level.
Absolutely.
Tier one, right? That's the story.
Right,
everybody
right.
wants to be tier one of zoos. So
there you go.
Steve Marshall.
Yes.
Director, thank you very much. Dr. Vicky, veterinarian there, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Adios.